A 3-week swing through the heartland in the far west had gone surprisingly well. So far as I am able to judge, Taft reported to his brother Charles, the trip I have made through the west has helped me. On a sweltering summer day in Columbus, more than 20,000 people had gathered to hear him speak. It was as great a meeting as they ever had in Ohio, Taft happily noted. In Kentucky, he had spoken to a fine audience of 4,000 people. In Oklahoma, an immense hall was filled to suffocation. And in Denver, he was greeted by every politician in the state and every state officer. Not only had Taft's formal speeches gone more smoothly, he had also become increasingly comfortable waving and making brief remarks to the crowds clustered at train stations along his route. Personal contact, Taft acknowledged, does a great deal. His clear blue eyes and famous smile, the New York Times reported, made all who met Taft feel glad and sociable and sincere. Buoyed by his warm reception everywhere he traveled, Taft took Roosevelt's ominous musings in stride. "Nellie was out of patience with the president's letter," he told Charles, "but I understand exactly his state of mind." Under the hammering of the New York papers and the disposition to press Hughes on, he has become a little more discouraged, Taft explained, claiming that, "I don't think he knows as much about the matter as I do, for I have crossed the country and been in all parts of it." Regardless of his current optimism, he promised his brother that he was not getting into a situation where a failure to get the nomination would render him bitter or indeed disappointed. Rather, he assured Charles, "I think that in your general earnestness and zeal on my behalf, a defeat would be more disappointing to you than to me." The day before his scheduled departure for a long-promised visit to the Philippines, Taft responded to Roosevelt's letter. "I fully understand the difficulties of your position and exactly how you feel in respect to the candidacy of myself and the others," he began. "I have been, however, agreeably surprised to receive the expressions of goodwill which I found in the trip across the continent." Acknowledging that one hears the things one likes to hear, he had found overwhelming evidence of affirmative support across the nation. Nonetheless, he was prepared to learn at any time during his Pacific journey that his boom had busted. "Whatever the outcome," Taft insisted, "he would remain grateful for the great compliment you have paid me in taking an interest in the matter, and for making my boom at all possible." Will, Nellie, with 10-year-old Charlie in tow, sailed for the Philippines on September 13th. Taft met with officials in Japan and China for several weeks before heading to Manila. The former Governor General was scheduled to open the first Philippine assembly. Taft had long considered creation of a popularly elected assembly a vital step toward eventual Filipino sovereignty. While the Philippine Commission still exercised executive powers, the new assembly would have the right to initiate legislation or to modify, amend, shape, or defeat legislation proposed by the Commission. As the first parliament ever freely elected in Asia, historian Stanley Carnot explains, the assembly was a tribute to the liberalism of U.S. colonial rule. But American democracy, it was not. Only those who owned land, paid taxes, and demonstrated literacy were allowed to vote. Taft feared he would encounter a chill upon reaching Manila, rather than the exuberant welcome of 2 years earlier. Since that time, the movement for independence had gained momentum, casting an unfavorable light on his prediction that it would take generations to prepare the people for self-rule. But his misgivings proved unfounded. The enthusiasm of the welcome, he related to Charles, exceeded anything he had experienced before, and it was the more delightful in that it was unexpected. The reception was particularly gratifying, he added, because it showed that the common people, along with the wealthier classes, celebrated his role in creating the National Assembly. He began his address by frankly admitting that he had not changed his mind about the duration required to achieve genuine sovereignty, but conceded that the question would be determined largely by the success of the new assembly. He wisely acknowledged that the United States, unused to the undertaking of colonial rule, and lacking a trained body of colonial administrators and civil servants, had made serious missteps. Adventurers and military men unsuited by character or experience for the serious work of public service had delayed effective government in the islands. In addition, he lamented the dilatory pace of American investment and roundly criticized the United States Congress for failing to reduce the tariff on the major Philippine exports of tobacco products and sugar. Yet, despite these obstacles, he believed the islands had made great advancements. Hundreds of thousands of Filipino children were attending school. Sanitation services and general public health had significantly improved, and a judicial system was now in place. Furthermore, he noted, miles of new roads and street railways had been built, a civil service had been established, and the problems with the Catholic Church had been largely settled. Taft ended his oration by extending his congratulations upon the auspicious beginning of your legislative life, and conveying his heartfelt sympathy in the work which you are about to undertake. At the inaugural ball, Taft once again won hearts with his graceful execution of the complex national dance, the Rigodon. Will and Nellie attended 1,001 events in the days that followed, inspecting projects that had been completed since their last visit, and renewing old friendships and acquaintances at a succession of dances, parties, and banquets. Everybody, Nellie happily noted, was glad to see us. The Tafts remained in the Philippines from mid-October through the first week of November, far removed from the stock market collapse that threatened both Roosevelt's legacy and Taft's candidacy. In October, a series of difficulties on Wall Street escalated into what later became known as the Panic of 1907. Stock prices had been slumping since the previous March. In July and August, a number of companies, including a mining firm and a major street railway company, fell into bankruptcy. As industrial production slackened toward summer's end, experts calculated that stock market losses approached $1 billion. Wall Street blamed Theodore Roosevelt's crusades against business for the decline, arguing that his excessive regulation had paralyzed the economy. By slow and insidious degrees, the Sun editorialized, he has upset the public confidence, arrayed class against class, and fomented mistrust and hatred. The New York Times concurred, tracing the country's ills to the administration's deep-seated, undiscriminating hostility to business. By going up and down the country, planting the doctrine of discontent, another critic charged, Roosevelt had sowed the wind, and we will reap the whirlwind. Union Pacific Railroad President E.H. Harriman, a lifelong Republican, bitterly claimed that he would take Bryan or Hearst rather than Roosevelt. We cannot be worse off than we are now with that man in the White House. In a defiant rejoinder, Roosevelt dispensed with his characteristic even-handed rhetoric. He stridently railed against certain malefactors of great wealth who conspired to bring about as much financial distress as they possibly can in order to discredit the policy of the government, and thereby to secure a reversal of that policy so that they may enjoy the fruits of their own evil doing. These plutocrats, he charged, would even welcome hard times or a panic to install a safe type in the White House. They are as blind to some of the tendencies of the time as the French noblesse was before the French Revolution. Those business interests that shrank from regulation, the president suggested, should examine their own operations. He was responsible for turning on the light, he noted proudly, not for what the light showed. Curiously, Roosevelt omitted all mention of the muckraking journalists who had proved so instrumental in illuminating industrial abuses. As summer turned to early fall, Roosevelt continued to frame the downturn as a temporary period of weakness, part of a worldwide contraction over a period of great prosperity. Unwilling to cancel his agenda, he left Washington on September 29th to deliver a series of speeches in the West, a trip that would culminate in a 10-day bear hunt in northeast Louisiana. Yet, while Roosevelt hunted bear, the bear market savaged Wall Street and the financial crisis deepened. In early October, banking moguls F. Augustus Hines and Charles W. Morse drove up copper prices in an attempt to corner the market. Their sensational failure and the resulting depression of stock value might have remained an isolated incident if news had not leaked that their costly speculation had been funded by the stately Knickerbocker Trust Company, the second largest investment bank in New York. Spooked by rumors that the venerable institution might fail, investors stood in queues outside the bank doors from dawn till dusk attempting to reclaim their funds. On the afternoon of October 22nd, the Knickerbocker ran out of money and was forced to shutter its offices. 3 weeks later, Bank President Charles T. Barney committed suicide. Evidence that the respected firm had abandoned sound banking practices to gamble with customers' deposits shattered confidence in other financial institutions. In the days that followed, customers rushed to retrieve money, some standing all night on the sidewalks, others sleeping in the vestibules. Reports indicated that hardly a bank or trust company was spared, as the panic threatened to compromise the nation's entire financial structure. In the absence of a centralized banking system, 70-year-old J.P. Morgan became a one-man Federal Reserve. The magnificent library at his Madison Avenue house was designated Panic Headquarters. Surrounded by rare books, Renaissance paintings, and exquisite tapestries, Morgan and his partners met with a carefully selected group of leading bankers. Day after day, often late into the night, this financial cabal monitored the precarious situation, transferring monies from one bank to another, declaring which institutions to save, and then raising sufficient funds to rescue them. Within 2 days, the bankers had pledged nearly $10 million. As Roosevelt hurried back to Washington, Treasury Secretary George Cortelyou took a day train to New York. Meeting with Morgan's group that evening, he promised that the government would add $25 million to the bankers' fund to be distributed at the Morgan's discretion. It was an extraordinary transference of power to a private banker, biographer Ron Chernow observes. The next day, reporters noted that immense bags of bank securities were delivered to the U.S. Sub-Treasury and J.P. Morgan's headquarters. This quick action saved dozens of banks and trust companies, including the venerable Trust Company of America. Despite these efforts to stabilize the banking system, stock prices continued to tumble. On Thursday, October 24th, the president of the New York Stock Exchange broke the news to Morgan that his brokers no longer had the cash to continue trading. Determined to avoid a shutdown that would likely precipitate the wholesale collapse of financial institutions across the city, Morgan called an emergency meeting. Less than 30 minutes had elapsed before a messenger brought word that Morgan's group had pledged $25 million to keep the exchange open. Elated at this reprieve, exuberant stockbrokers hooted and cheered, hailing J.P. Morgan the man of the hour. The crisis had proven that Morgan was still the chief among the country's financiers, the New York Evening Mail observed, the one leader who could inspire the confidence of the multitude and command the resources of the nation. Just as one firestorm was contained, however, a new blaze erupted. On November 1st, Morgan learned that Moore & Sly, a leading brokerage house, was on the verge of bankruptcy. Understanding that the firm's failure would bring down a few more stories of the tottering financial pyramid, Morgan evolved an ingenious plan. The troubled brokerage house owned a large stake in the Tennessee Coal, Iron, and Railroad Company, one of the few significant combinations to escape the grip of United States Steel. In a meeting with U.S. Steel's chairman, Judge Elbert Gary, Morgan proposed that U.S. Steel purchase TC&I, exchanging its own solid bonds for TC&I bonds to redeem Moore & Sly. As a precondition, Gary insisted on Roosevelt's assurance that the purchase would not trigger an antitrust suit. "Can you go at once?" Morgan demanded. That evening, Judge Gary and H.C. Frick took the overnight train to Washington. Meeting with the president at 8 o'clock the following morning, the two U.S. Steel representatives maintained that, under ordinary circumstances, they would not consider purchasing the stock, which was priced somewhat in excess of the firm's true value. Nevertheless, they believed it was to the interest of every responsible businessman to avoid a general industrial smash-up. Roosevelt assured them that he felt no public duty to file suit under the Sherman Antitrust Act. The announcement of the deal not only saved Moore and Sly, it also helped restore confidence in the market. When the terms of the TC&I purchase were made public, however, Roosevelt came under heavy criticism. John Moody, a respected financial analyst, termed the $45 million purchase price the best bargain ever made in the purchase of a piece of property. The coal and iron ore deposits alone, he estimated, were worth hardly less than $1 billion. Some suspected that Roosevelt had been hoodwinked into legitimizing U.S. Steel's bid to swallow up a lively competitor while wrapping itself in the cloak of public spirit. Roosevelt adamantly denied such charges. The nation trembled on the brink, he contended, justifying his decision by pointing to the speed and volatility of the financial markets. Events moved with such speed that it was necessary to decide and to act on the instant as each successive crisis arose. A decision had been necessary before the stock market opened that morning. I would have showed myself a timid and unworthy public servant if, in that extraordinary crisis, I had not acted precisely as I did. In the years ahead, however, the contentious decision would open a painful rift in Roosevelt's friendship with William Howard Taft. Although the immediate danger of the financial panic subsided, a general malaise began to seep into every sector of the economy, costing laborers their jobs and farmers their livelihood. Whether I am or am not in any degree responsible for the panic, I shall certainly be held responsible, Roosevelt grumbled to his physician, Dr. Alexander Lambert. The big moneyed men had long since reached a pitch of acute emotional insanity, he told Kermit. That anger-fueled hysteria would begin to infect even friends and supporters, he suspected, because when the average man loses his money, he is simply like a wounded snake and strikes right and left at anything, innocent or the reverse, that presents itself as conspicuous in his mind. From all sides, Ida Tarbell observed, the business world, the press, leaders of public opinion, there came such a berating of the president as a man has rarely had to endure. No longer simply a destroyer of credit, Roosevelt had now become an assassin of property. From Kansas, William Allen White wrote to cheer his friend. I feel personally hurt by all this abuse that is being heaped on you, he began. The whole system is bending its energy to turn back the clock, and the prayers and the assistance of every good American should be with you in this crisis. Roosevelt found some consolation in White's words, but remained pessimistic about his prospects. I care a great deal more for such a letter as you have written to me than I do for the attacks that are being made upon me, he replied. If there is much depression, if we meet hard times, then a great number of honest and well-meaning people will gradually come to believe in the truth of these attacks, and I shall probably end my term of service as president under a more or less dark cloud of obloquy. If so, I shall be sorry, of course, but I shall neither regret what I have done nor alter my line of conduct. On the morning of November 16th, Ray Baker arrived at the White House for a scheduled discussion about his series on race in America. Instead, when Baker noticed a thin red pamphlet called The Roosevelt Panic on the president's desk, the conversation quickly turned to the economy. Wall Street, Roosevelt explained, had circulated this incendiary tract to destroy his program of reform. For 2 hours, Roosevelt shared his vantage on the troubling situation. It looks now, he told Baker, as though there would be letdown in business throughout the country for some time to come. I shall be blamed for it. My enemies will make capital of it. It is probable that before next summer I shall be the bête noire of the country. While still hopeful for Taft's nomination, the president feared that the country at the next election would have to choose between an extreme radical like Bryan and a Republican reactionary. That in either event, the moderate reform movement, which he advocates, would be lost sight of. Continuing the conversation with Baker the next morning, Roosevelt repeatedly insisted that the fight must be carried through. The idea of either a reactionary or Bryan as the next president, Baker observed, seemed to set his fighting blood to running. The journalist departed with a growing conviction that Roosevelt was seriously considering another run. "A man may sometimes have to jeopardize his own soul," the president had cryptically commented, "when the interests of the country are at stake." And, in truth, Roosevelt was still brooding over the prospects of another term. "I hate for personal reasons to get out of the fight here," he told one friend. "I have the uncomfortable feeling that I may possibly be shirking a duty. The leader who quits the fight before it is finished deserves little respect," he confided to another supporter. Nevertheless, he countered, "a political leader must understand the temper and convictions of the people." And while he believed he could win the Republican nomination, Roosevelt had misgivings about the general election. Nothing would be more humiliating than to break his word and then lose. The time had come, Roosevelt decided, to make clear that he would not seek a third term under any circumstance. On the evening of December 11th, he released an unusually succinct statement. "On the night after my election, I made the following announcement." Verbatim, he repeated his pledge renouncing a third term and concluded with an equally curt finality. "I have not changed and shall not change the decision thus announced." Roosevelt's proclamation arrived like a clap of thunder out of the clear sky, the National Tribune reported. Washington has been throbbing with political gossip ever since. Derisive speculation abounded among the president's critics. "I suppose he has come to the conclusion that it would not be worthwhile for him to run," Democratic Senator Tillman charged, stridently observing that "the pitiful condition into which he and Cortelyou have got things shows that he could not be elected." Although Roosevelt would undoubtedly do his utmost to name the man who would carry out his policies, William Randolph Hearst observed, only time would tell whether the popularity he once enjoyed, or the rejection he currently endured, would prove more potent for his chosen candidate. In Republican circles, commentary focused primarily on Taft's brightening prospects. With Roosevelt definitely and positively out of the presidential race, party leaders were free to come out squarely for Taft. California Senator Frank Flint insisted that the state had been for Taft all along and could now openly declare its support. Kansas Senator Long concurred, calling Taft's candidacy the only one worth considering. As the political world debated Taft's future, Will and Nellie crossed the Atlantic on the SS Grant. They had cut short their round-the-world tour upon receiving news that Taft's mother was critically ill. Louise Taft had been in splendid health until the previous summer, when she had developed an acute inflammation of the gallbladder. Before his departure for the Philippines, Taft had stopped at the old family mansion in Millbury, Massachusetts, where his mother and her sister Delia resided together. While doctors considered Louise's condition serious, Will and his brothers were convinced that her cheerful nature and her strength, constitution, and courage would carry her through. She remained mentally clear and for a time seemed to be on the road to recovery. On her 80th birthday in September, Annie Taft reported, "Her cheeks were as rosy as a young girl's, and she was happy as a child at seeing us. There was something marvelous about the youthfulness of her face." As winter approached, however, she slowly but steadily lost ground. On December 4th, Charles telegraphed Will in St. Petersburg that the end was near. "Still have hope that she will survive until you arrive," Charles wrote 2 days later. But Taft's ship had departed Hamburg, Germany, when he received word that his mother was dead. When the SS Grant arrived at quarantine in New York, a courier handed Taft a confidential letter from the president. "I hope you will say nothing for publication until you see me," Roosevelt cautioned. "Things have become somewhat intricate, and you want to consider well what steps you are to take before taking them," he explained. "A great many of your ardent supporters became convinced that your canvass was being hurt by the refusal of many people to accept my declination as final, and that numbers of people who were sincerely attached to you, but who were even more devoted to me, did not come out for you because they thought I was still a possibility. I therefore decided to make one more public statement. Neither politics nor strategy were foremost in William Taft's agenda. No sooner had he landed than he made plans for an immediate trip to Cincinnati. "I was very much pained not to be able to come here to attend the funeral," he told a friend. Missing the final epoch in his mother's life had left him with a terrible sense of something wanting, a loss he hoped to mitigate by laying a wreath on her grave and calling on her old friends. While his mother's death represented a great change for the entire family, he took solace in the knowledge that, through 8 decades, she had lived according to her own design, never riddled by a longing for something else. Ever a force to be reckoned with, Louise Taft had been a formative power within her own family, just as she had helped shape every community in which she had lived. And although she would not see the new chapter that was beginning for her son, William, Louise Taft had never doubted his devoted and amiable soul. Chapter 21 Kingmaker and King. By the time he returned to Washington in early winter of 1908, Taft found that the push for his nomination had caught its second wind and straightened out for the home stretch. In the wake of Roosevelt's reaffirmation that he would not run again, William Nelson of the Kansas City Star informed Taft that the state now regarded him as its first and only choice. A resolution in his favor had gone through with a whoop. Likewise, the Colorado State Committee endorsed Taft unanimously, and a poll among likely Michigan delegates showed Taft trouncing the field by a 2-to-1 margin. Buoyed by the widening show of support, Taft began to actively engage in his campaign for the first time. On the eve of a Republican State Committee meeting in West Virginia, he assured Governor William Dawson that his endorsement would be a decisive blow, clinching not only West Virginia, but neighboring states as well. "If you could bring this about," he encouraged the governor, "I shall be everlastingly grateful." He solicited activists for information on the political climate in their regions and responded to encouraging editorials with handwritten notes, telling the publisher of the St. Paul Pioneer Press and Tribune that the friendly tone of a recent editorial had made his whole day and week brighter. Increasingly comfortable at the podium, Taft responded to questions with rapid-fire retorts and witty sallies. Asked at Cooper Union why a blacklisted laborer should not be allowed an injunction as well as a boycotted capitalist, he replied succinctly, "He should be. Were I on the bench, I would give him one quickly." Explaining his preference for capitalism over socialism, Taft wryly observed that he did not trust a governmental committee to determine the worth of a lawyer, doctor, carpenter, or judge, unless, of course, he himself was a member of that committee. Only once did Taft's words come back to haunt him. To the daunting question of what those unable to find work during the recession might do, he had earnestly answered, "God knows, they have my deepest sympathy. It is an awful case when a man is willing to work and is put in this position." Critics seized upon the phrase, "God knows," to suggest Taft's want of empathy for the laboring class. Nonetheless, when the long question and answer session came to an end, it was the general verdict that the secretary was entitled to the referee's decision. And when the gong rang, the crowd swarmed into the ring to grasp the victor's hand. By late January, New York Governor Hughes was the sole remaining candidate with a national following who could potentially challenge Taft for the Republican nomination. Taft's supporters urged him to fight Hughes for the New York delegates, but Taft insisted that a nasty struggle for the governor's home fort would ultimately hurt Republican chances in the fall. This decision drew praise from party leaders, but Roosevelt continued to worry that Hughes was a threat. Aware that the governor intended to deliver a major campaign speech on January 31st, Roosevelt deliberately chose that same date to present a special message to Congress. The president's words proved to be so blistering, so genuinely sensational, that they stole headlines from Hughes's sane and sound address. Roosevelt's anger over the legislature's persistent refusal to act on his recommendations had been mounting for weeks. When the Supreme Court ruled the 1906 Employers Liability Act unconstitutional in early January, the president was irate, calling it a matter of humiliation to the nation, that an employee who suffered an accident through no fault of his own would not be protected. In no other prominent industrial country in the world, he charged, could such gross injustice occur. He challenged Congress to enact a new liability law and take up his additional regulatory measures without delay. Any implication that such regulations had precipitated the recent panic was wrong-headed, he maintained. In fact, as far as individual blame could be ascribed, the collapse was due to the speculative folly and flagrant dishonesty of a few men of great wealth who seek to shield themselves from the effects of their own wrongdoing by ascribing its results to the actions of those who have sought to put a stop to the wrongdoing. While critics accused Roosevelt of prostituting his high office and the machinery of government in order to play petty and mean politics against Hughes, the substance of his speech garnered widespread approval. It hurls defiance at a legislature that thought in its folly that the day of Roosevelt was done, the Denver Post observed, contending that it appeals beyond Congress to the hearts of the American people. The Boston Globe also praised the president's sledgehammer eloquence, while the Chicago Tribune rated it one of America's great state papers. Even those who considered its tone incongruous with the preconceptions of presidential dignity acknowledged that the message had caught everyone's attention. "It has maddened my enemies," Roosevelt told Kermit, "but I believe it has helped Taft's nomination." A New York World cartoon aptly illustrated the strategic timing of the president's address. Hughes is pictured trying to deliver his speech while Roosevelt beats an enormous bass drum, drowning out the governor's words. Delighted by the image, Taft wrote to the World editor and requested the original caricature. "It records something which may prove to be an epoch in the campaign," he explained. "I should like very much to have it as part of my memorabilia." By spring, the president noted with satisfaction, the Hughes boom has collapsed, and Taft's nomination all but settled. Still, Roosevelt continued to monitor every aspect of the campaign, counseling and comforting Taft through the inevitable vicissitudes. In March, for instance, a subordinate in his Columbus campaign office released a statement declaring that Taft would prove more acceptable to the business community than his predecessor. The statement reprinted a series of quotes from the Wall Street Journal, touting Taft as deliberative and measured in his nature and training, a needful antidote to the impulsive, intemperate president. Both Taft's temperament and his record, the Journal had suggested, boded distinctly against any conclusion that he would continue Mr. Roosevelt's methods. Taft immediately repudiated the release and fired the employee, but the incident continued to disturb him. "Good heavens, you beloved individual," Roosevelt placated him. "You'll have any number of such experiences, though not as many as I have had, and unlike you, I have frequently been myself responsible." Far more troubling, Taft confided, was the painful experience of finding himself held up to execration as an enemy of the black race for his role as Secretary of War during the Brownsville incident. From his abolitionist father, Taft had inherited a deep sympathy and support for the rights of the freed slaves. Indefatigably, he had worked in the Philippines to oppose the color caste. Regardless of Taft's record of combating inequality, scores of traditionally Republican black leaders now considered him a menace and declared they would never, never support him. While some in Taft's camp suggested he distance himself from the president by publicly discussing his attempt to delay the order, Taft refused. Loyalty trumped political advantage. Roosevelt finally took action himself, issuing a formal statement claiming entire responsibility for the dismissal of the Negro troops and absolving Taft of any role in the decision. As news of Roosevelt's statement spread through the black community, resistance to Taft's nomination dissipated. "We are satisfied," declared the editor of a popular black newspaper, "that President Roosevelt was responsible for the discharge of the soldiers, and we believe that Mr. Taft had nothing at all to do with it." In late spring, however, speaking at Grant's tomb on Decoration Day, Taft inadvertently instigated his own controversy when he referred to the Civil War general's predilection for strong drink, which had forced his resignation from the army. Intended as a tribute to the wonderful resolution, strength of character, and military genius that allowed Grant to triumph over adversity, Taft's address sought to project a fallible exemplar for young people rather than a mythical figure painted as perfect without temptation. Whatever his intention, many veterans perceived Taft's depiction of Grant as a desecration. "I trust you will have the grace to go and hang yourself, rather than attempt to belittle a nation by running for the presidency," the commander of the New Hampshire Sons of Veterans histrionically suggested. Across the country, outraged veterans accused Taft of insulting the mighty dead, and warned that they would not forget his heartless remarks on Election Day. When Roosevelt and Taft reconvened, the president stood at mock attention, solemnly exclaiming, "Viva Grant!" He advised Taft not to fret. "It is not going to hurt you. I have got the public accustomed to hearing the truth from statesmen or politicians, whichever we might be termed, without it changing the destinies of the nation." The president's confidence, it seemed, was well-founded. Such stumbles did little to stay the momentum of Taft's campaign. "All opposition to Taft has died down, and he will be nominated easily," Roosevelt assured a friend at the end of May. The surge of support in recent months represented an astonishing achievement for Mr. Taft, the Chicago Evening Post observed, affirming Taft's ability to evade the many snares that had beset his campaign. "We doubt whether the history of the country has ever recorded a more remarkable feat by a presidential candidate than this utter routing of each and every anti-convention attack upon him." Roosevelt's satisfaction with the progress of Taft's campaign as summer arrived could not mask his chagrin that Congress had refused to act on his proposals for a second straight year. "Congress's ending, by no means in a blaze of glory," the president complained to Whitelaw Reid, ambassador to Great Britain. The reigning conservatives in the House and Senate, he grumbled, felt a relief that they did not try to conceal at the fact that I was not to remain as president. While a few significant measures passed, including a revised Employer Liability Act and child labor law bill for the District of Columbia, the core of Roosevelt's progressive recommendations had again been ignored. With practical unanimity, journalists referred to the session as the Do-Nothing Congress. In his frustration, Roosevelt failed to appreciate that conservatives were emboldened not only by his impending departure, but also by the diminished power of the muckraking journalists, whose popular exposures of corporate abuse had played a collaborative role in pressuring Congress to act. Nor did the president acknowledge that his celebrated address castigating muckrakers had crystallized a nascent sentiment of disfavor toward the new journalism. 2 years after Roosevelt's diatribe, a survey of leading monthlies revealed a sharp decline in the fiery investigative pieces that had fueled public demand for reform. "The noon of the muckraker's day is past," an Iowa newspaper declared. "Look upon these magazines now," observed the New York Times. "Read them from cover to cover. Where are the muckrakers?" Magazine publishers were acutely sensitive to capricious public sentiment, the Times concluded. Like the manufacturers of print cloth and summer silks, they were prepared to offer any pattern the reader desires. "We judge that quiet patterns are now in favor." While the country sought respite from grim catalogs of wrongdoing, members of the old McClure's team struggled with their vacillating feelings toward Theodore Roosevelt and the square deal. William Allen White remained the most passionate champion of the president. Embarking on a biographical sketch of Taft for the May issue of The American, White first consulted with Roosevelt. "Don't hold the knife edge of your balance so perfectly poised in this piece that your readers won't see your bias," Roosevelt had counseled him. White needed little prompting, for he had developed a genuine affection for Taft after spending several days with him on a train from Kansas City to Washington. In the weeks that followed, the two men continued to correspond as White sought to fill in details of Taft's career. In lengthy letters to White, Taft meticulously credited every mentor and benefactor who had helped facilitate his success. "The meanest man in the world," Taft remarked, "is the man who forgets the old friends that helped him on an early day and over early difficulties." The resulting piece portrayed Taft as an amiable giant who had triumphed through the warmth of his personality, his prodigious capacity for hard, consecutive work, and his judicial instinct to grapple with every issue without resting and without fatigue until it is settled or solved. No political figure has been better suited than Taft to pursue Roosevelt's unfinished business, White argued, to push nearly a dozen pending antitrust suits through the courts, to resolve the imperfections in recently enacted epoch-making laws. "The times demand not a man bearing promises of new things," White concluded, "but a man who can finish the things begun, who, with a steady hand and a heart always kind and a mind always generously just, can clean off the desk." The piece delighted Roosevelt. It would be impossible to get two men of fairly strong character and fairly marked individuality who would agree more closely, he responded to White, "unless it is either one of us and Taft." Ida Tarbell had long shared White's fascination with Roosevelt, though she found his pugnacity and relish for war distasteful. "I wobble terribly whenever I see him face to face," she confessed to Baker. "He seems so amazing." She had genuinely exulted in his crusade against the trusts, sharing his conviction that the government had a right and duty to regulate corporations for the sake of democracy. Roosevelt was in the right, she insisted. Corporations exist not for themselves, but for the people. As Tarbell immersed herself in the tariff issue, however, she began to suspect the president a less amazing figure than she had initially imagined. Having envisioned Roosevelt as the St. George who would marshal popular support for downward tariff revision after the 1907 panic, she was sorely disappointed by his unwillingness to risk Republican Party unity. Still, Tarbell remained a proponent of the square deal, trusting that investigation, legislation, regulation, and judicial proceedings could right the wrongs of the industrial world. By 1908, Lincoln Steffens had arrived at very different conclusions. Steffens no longer trusted that the square deal could solve the nation's gross inequities of wealth and power, believing that more radical measures were necessary, including public ownership of corrupt railroads and trusts. "I certainly am socialistic," he told his sister, "but I am not a socialist." In the June issue of Everybody's, he published an article comparing the leadership styles of T.R., Taft, and La Follette. Although he praised Roosevelt for galvanizing the public and predicted that Taft would faithfully follow his predecessor's regulatory course, he argued that La Follette alone was fighting against the system itself. Roosevelt responded to Steffens with a 2,000-word rebuttal. "You contend," he began, "that Taft and I are good people of limited vision who fight against specific evils with no idea of fighting against the fundamental evil." After a quarter of a century in politics, Roosevelt observed, he had found that change was realized by men who take the next step, not those who theorize about the 200th step. He pointed out that it was Lincoln, not Wendell Phillips, who saved the Union and abolished slavery. Indeed, history suggested that those, like La Follette, who fought the system in the abstract, accomplished mighty little good. Roosevelt closed by suggesting that Steffens visit the White House to continue their dialogue. Steffens replied that they had always argued about politics with such mutual understanding and genuine affection that he now felt closer to the president than to many who shared his own views. By the final year of Roosevelt's presidency, Ray Baker had likewise come to question his leadership style, though he still continued to regard him as the most interesting personality in the country. In a 1908 article for The American, Baker located the source of the president's strength in what the philosopher William James termed the art of energizing, the ability to command ordinary talents to an extraordinary degree. While most people never tapped their vast stores of hidden energies, Baker contended that Roosevelt succeeded through the simple device of self-control and self-discipline, of using every power he possesses to its utmost limit, a dazzling, even appalling spectacle of a human engine driven at full speed. Despite being an ordinary shot, he had practiced methodically to become a world-class hunter. Lacking the succinct poetic clarity of Lincoln's literary genius, he had nonetheless produced an astonishingly versatile body of work. While preaching simple homilies and banal maxims, he had nonetheless reached the hearts of his countrymen and given the people voice. After a decade of observation, however, Baker had reached a less flattering assessment of the president. Roosevelt never leads. He always follows. He acts, but he acts only when he thinks the crowd is behind him. Upon all the great issues which he has championed, the country was prepared before he entered the arena. While he had pushed his agenda valiantly and fearlessly, Baker argued, the times now demanded a thinker, someone who could deal with the unjust tariff structure and the underlying conflict between the few and the many, who could formulate a European system of comprehensive social insurance to protect the injured, the sick, and the aged. Baker's musings provoked a lively correspondence with Roosevelt. "I think you lay altogether too much stress," Roosevelt told the reporter, "upon your theory that everywhere and at all times political thought divides itself into two opposing forces, driving what Baker had called the fundamental conflict between the few and the many. In the South," Roosevelt pointed out, "the tension between the races reached immeasurably farther into the souls of men than any struggle between the poor and the rich." While he believed in equal opportunities for all, he decried the inflammatory and unprofitable language of class warfare, which impeded the moral struggle to improve man as a man. "I wish as much as you do that we had reached the stage in our civilization where we could avoid the hatred and the demagogy of ignorance and class strife," Baker promptly replied. In the present situation, he maintained, class action by unions and parties seemed indispensable. "Would any amount of effort to improve the Russian Jewish tailor of the East Side as a man make much headway?" he wondered. "Unless there is a determined effort to change his environment and the institutions which help make him poor, downtrodden, outcast." One evening, less than a week after this exchange of letters, the two men talked at the White House until midnight. And for the first time in their long acquaintance, the ever-exuberant president struck. "Unless there is a determined effort to change his environment and the institutions which help make him poor, downtrodden, outcast." One evening, less than a week after this exchange of letters, the two men talked at the White House until midnight. And for the first time in their long acquaintance, the ever-exuberant president struck Baker as a weary man. Roosevelt disclosed his plans to spend a year big game hunting in the wilds of Africa when his term ended. "The best thing I can do is to go entirely away," he told Baker, "out of reach of everything here." He admitted that he believed his time had come and gone, that he was through. When Baker suggested that the people might not be through with him, the president responded with a curious finality, a sort of sadness, unlike anything Baker had heard from him. "New issues are coming up," Roosevelt acknowledged. "People are going to discuss economic questions more and more, the tariff, currency, banks. They are hard questions, and I am not deeply interested in them. My problems are moral problems, and my teaching has been plain morality." Never, Baker later reflected, had he seen the president in a more human mood. Roosevelt's wistful demeanor on the eve of the Republican National Convention in Chicago revealed residual misgivings about his ironclad pledge to forego a third term. "When you see me quoted in the press as welcoming the rest I will have after March the 3rd, take no stock in it," he informed his military aide, Archie Butt. "I have enjoyed every moment of this so-called arduous and exacting task." For all 7 years of his tenure, he proudly told historian George Trevelyan that he had been president, emphatically, utilizing every ounce of power there was in the office. At times, he was plagued by ugly qualms about abandoning great work simply to be true to his word. Yet if he did answer the call to run again, he feared that even those who had spurred him on would suffer a shock of disappointment at an unseemly quest to hold the office longer than it was deemed wise that Washington should hold it. Roosevelt was not the only one preoccupied by the tantalizing prospect of a third term. As Chicago began to throb with the confusion and excitement of arriving throngs in preparation for the convention, a stampede for Roosevelt remained a distinct possibility. "Taft has nothing to fear from any combination of opponents," the Washington Post remarked. "The only man who can defeat him is President Roosevelt." In journalistic circles, the odds of a stampede to nominate Roosevelt at the first mention of his name proved an unfailing topic for conjecture, and the explosive possibility of its injection at the psychological moment was widely anticipated. Any large political gathering, the San Francisco Chronicle observed, can easily become a mob ready to accept what psychologists call suggestion. As expectations began to mount, two antithetical factions enhanced the likelihood of a Roosevelt stampede. For progressive and moderate Republicans who, in their heart of hearts, preferred Roosevelt to anyone else, hope remained that if actually nominated, the president would feel compelled to accept the honor despite his repeated refusals. The agenda of the second group was far more calculating. For Taft's reactionary opponents, known as the Allies, a stampede would be the last card in their effort to break Taft's majority on the first ballot. By pushing for a third term, they hoped to create a diversion against Taft and weaken him as a candidate. If the president then refused to accept the nomination, as they anticipated, the door would open for a second or third ballot to nominate one of their own, Cannon, Knox, or Fairbanks. The sky was full of sunshine on June 16th, the first day of the convention. The band played patriotic airs as delegates found their seats on the floor and spectators piled into the galleries. Barely audible above the din, the presiding officer's tribute to the glories of the party did not seem designed to set the blood tingling. Toledo Mayor Brand Whitlock observed a restlessness in the gallery, reminiscent of that expectant interest in which multitudes view an animal trainer at work. Down in their hearts, the secret human wish, or half-wish, that the animals may turn and eat the trainer. The analogy, he said, served only to point out that the spectators longed for something to happen. But nothing happened. The agenda for the second day of the convention promised to sate the crowd's desire for excitement. Though Will and Nellie remained in Washington with their 17-year-old daughter Helen and 8-year-old son Charlie, the rest of the Taft clan descended upon Chicago. 2 hours before the convention proceedings opened at 10 a.m., William Howard Taft arrived at his War Department office. His quarters at the old executive office building included a large reception room for visitors, an adjoining space for his secretary and two clerks, and a private office with a desk, couch, and several comfortable chairs. Electricians equipped the office to receive telegraph messages directly from the convention hall, and a long-distance telephone line allowed Frank Hitchcock, Taft's national campaign manager, to reach him from the floor of the Coliseum. To relieve anxiety, Taft plunged into the business of the day, reviewing routine matters with his secretary. When a photographer arrived and suggested that he pose expectantly by the telephone, Taft balked. "I do not sit at the telephone," he laughed, explaining that telephone messages are taken by somebody else. "I'll not do anything unnatural." Nellie arrived at noon, taking a seat at her husband's desk, while young Charlie stationed himself in the anteroom with the telegraph operator, ready to carry incoming messages to his mother. She read each dispatch aloud to the assembled gathering of associates and friends as Taft paced restlessly in and out of the office, intermittently occupying an easy chair by the window. Dozens of newspaper men and clerks gathered in the outer reception room. At 1:30, convention chair Senator Henry Cabot Lodge approached the podium to deliver the keynote address. For half an hour, the senator held the 14,000 attendees rapt with a powerful critique of the Democrats and a stirring defense of Republican policies, carefully avoiding any mention of Theodore Roosevelt. When he finally introduced the magic name, Lodge unleashed a wild, frenzied, uncontrollable stampede for Roosevelt. The point of Lodge's speech that touched a burning fuse to a dry powder was the simple observation that, to the great dismay of vested abuses and profitable wrongs, Roosevelt had fearlessly enforced the laws, becoming the best abused and most popular man in the United States today. Delegates and spectators exploded with a roar, clapping, whistling, stamping their feet. Hats, fans, umbrellas, flags, newspapers, arms, coats were waved, flapped, brandished, jiggled, while the audience chanted, 4 years more, 4 years more. When Lodge attempted to continue, his words were drowned in a volley of cheers that echoed from floor to ceiling. It seemed, one journalist remarked, as if the roof would blow off. This disruption was merely a trifle compared with what followed. After someone threw a 4-foot teddy bear into the air, delegates began tossing it from one state to another. Each time it appeared above the heads of the delegates, the Washington Post reported, it was a signal for another outburst. The convention was on the verge of a good-natured riot when a national committee man from Oklahoma captured and sat on the bear, successfully resisting all attempts to snatch it away. Bulletins describing these outbursts on the convention floor understandably produced anxiety for the little group assembled in Taft's office. Fortunately, Taft had departed to meet with Secretary Root about an official matter just before the pandemonium erupted. But Nellie was unnerved. Her anxiety was somewhat mollified when Frank Hitchcock called from the floor, assuring everyone that he was not at all alarmed, the Taft delegates would remain firm. Back in Chicago, the wild ovation persisted for a record 49 minutes, ceasing only when Lodge returned to the podium, wresting the crowd's attention by the force of his personality and the impact of his words. "That man is no friend to Theodore Roosevelt," he proclaimed, "who now, from any motive, seeks to urge him as a candidate for the great office which he has finally declined. The president has refused what his countrymen would gladly have given him. He says what he means and means what he says, and his party and his country will respect his wishes as they honor his high character and great public service." Aware that Lodge was the president's designated spokesman, and that he carried a letter confirming Roosevelt's refusal in case of his nomination, the gathering accepted the senator's words as the voice of the president. The convention quieted. The possibility of the stampede, feared by some and desired by many, had come and gone. Nellie was still seated at the desk receiving bulletins when Taft returned to the office. After learning of the excitement, he walked over to the White House, where the President and First Lady were preparing for a horseback ride through Rock Creek Park. William Loeb, Roosevelt's secretary, remarked that the convention had simply needed to blow off steam before moving forward. Archie Butt had never seen Roosevelt more ebullient. Flattered by the emotional outpouring, the President recognized that the convention had paid him the highest possible compliment without forcing a decision that threatened both his party's prospects and the credibility of his word. Taft, too, was smiling. A reassuring telegram had arrived from Frank Hitchcock. "The cheers for Roosevelt today will be for Taft tomorrow." When the convention opened the following day, Nellie resumed her customary position at her husband's desk. Charlie happily continued serving as messenger, and Miss Helen Taft, scheduled to attend Bryn Mawr College in the fall, joined the group as the nominating speeches for favorite sons were set to begin. Journalists remarked on the solidarity of the Taft family, particularly noting Nellie's unusual role as one of her husband's best advisors in every aspect of the campaign. A San Francisco Chronicle reporter described the atmosphere in the room as electric with excitement and suppressed nervous tension. Nellie strove to remain calm as she relayed reports of the enthusiastic cheering that greeted Ohio Congressman Burton's nominating speech for Taft. Delegates stood on their chairs as a large banner bearing Taft's picture was carried through the aisles, waving their hats and flags to a chorus of "Taft, Taft, Taft." A burst of good-natured laughter greeted a pair of ample trousers adorning a flagpole brandished by a member of the Texas delegation. "As pants the heart for cooling streams," they intoned, "so Texas pants for Taft." To better view the animated demonstration, Charles Taft climbed a stepladder on the edge of the Ohio delegation. His beaming smile revealed pride and pleasure in the accomplishments of a younger brother whom he had mentored and supported since the death of their father. Though less protracted than the frenzy unleashed by Roosevelt's name on the previous day, the exuberant response buoyed the spirits of Taft's supporters. By late afternoon, visitors inundated Taft's inner office, with reporters streaming in and out. Just before the balloting was set to begin, Nellie was handed a bulletin causing her to turn white as marble. A large lithograph of Roosevelt had been carried onto the stage, she relayed to the gathering, and once again the audience had erupted into a frenzy that made it impossible for Chairman Lodge to restore order. "Scarcely a word was spoken," one correspondent noted. "Men who ordinarily are not affected by nervousness hung over the telegraph instrument as though their lives depended upon the words which the stolid telegrapher was ticking out." Silence prevailed for nearly 15 minutes, until the next bulletin announced that 26 Massachusetts delegates had voted for Taft. No one could fathom how the roll call had reached Massachusetts until it was discovered that even as the demonstration continued unabated, Lodge had somehow proceeded with the vote. "Pay no attention to the crowd," he shouted to the clerk, declaring, "I shall not have the president made by a Chicago mob." 7 states managed to cast their votes before the mayhem finally subsided. "The scene was absolutely unique in American history," one correspondent noted, "the voting being taken during a terrific uproar in behalf of a man whose name was not before the convention." Shortly before 5:30, a telegram arrived declaring that the press associations had flashed the nomination of William Howard Taft. Her eyes aglow with excitement, Nellie read the news to the assembled throng. Bubbling over with happiness, she rose to embrace her husband, who laughed with the joy of a boy. A football rush followed as Taft's colleagues in the War Department arrived en masse to extend their congratulations. Moments later, a bulletin confirmed that the nomination was declared unanimous, and Secretary of State Root appeared to accompany Taft to an appointment at the War College. "You know how happy I feel over this," Root told the new nominee. "I do," Taft replied, giving the secretary a resounding whack on the back. The nominee warned Root that they would face a delay as he shook hands with the assembled reporters. "It will be a long time before you will be able to shake the newspaper men," Root quipped. Taft cordially greeted the boys in turn, but declined to make a statement. "Words don't frame themselves for me now," he humbly insisted, "but I don't deny that I am very happy." Roosevelt was engaged in a tennis game with Assistant Secretary of State Robert Bacon when he received word of Taft's nomination. He had prepared a formal statement, which he directed his secretary to release straightaway to the press. "The country is indeed to be congratulated upon the nomination of Mr. Taft. I have known him intimately for many years, and I have a peculiar feeling for him, because throughout that time we have worked for the same object, with the same purposes and ideals. I do not believe there can be found in the whole country a man so well fitted to be president." That evening, against a backdrop of music and fireworks, Taft addressed hundreds of his neighbors and friends from his doorstep. "A great honor has fallen upon me today to lead a great political party in the contest that is to come," he solemnly acknowledged. He then turned to Nellie, the real ruler of the family, acknowledging that no greater need of approval could be desired. Reminded that his 9 o'clock reception at the White House would begin in 2 minutes, he hastened walking in that direction. but when the congratulatory crowd thwarted his progress, he was forced to recruit the army band's wagon. "Does this outfit belong to anyone?" he inquired. "Everything belongs to you tonight," he was assured. He promptly jumped into the wagon and proceeded to the White House, where his old friend, the proud kingmaker, awaited. The convention completed its business the following day, nominating conservative New York Congressman James Sherman for vice president. Neither Roosevelt nor Taft was particularly happy with the choice of Sonny Jim. They had hoped to add a progressive from the West to the ticket, but when Albert Beveridge, Herbert Hadley, Jonathan Dolliver, and A.B. Cummins all refused, they had left the decision to the delegates. The platform, approved by the delegates, was equally unsatisfying. At Taft's insistence, it called for a special session to revise the tariff and create a postal savings bank system, but it diluted an anti-injunction plank and blamed Democrats for the failure to act on progressive measures exonerating the Republican majority. While Senators La Follette and Beveridge expressed disappointment, William Allen White defended the convention's work in an editorial. "We can't get all we desire," he opined. "A party is no place for a crank. If he cannot compromise and go forward, he should flock alone." "The next 4 months are going to be kind of a nightmare for me," Taft confessed to a friend shortly after the convention. Each morning he awakened with a certain degree of nervous uneasiness of what may appear in the newspaper, he explained. And though he could handle attacks manufactured out of whole cloth, those blending truth and falsehood were more troubling. To fortify himself, Taft planned to spend July and August at the Homestead, a celebrated resort hotel in Hot Springs, Virginia, where he could work, relax, and replenish his energies for the fall campaign. Situated atop the Blue Ridge Mountains, a short horseback ride from waterfalls and ancient woodlands, the Homestead boasted a majestic high-ceilinged lobby, a wide veranda surrounding the entire building, and an 18-hole golf course. Nellie, Will, and Charlie occupied the presidential suite, with a private balcony overlooking the grassy links. In addition, a 5-room office suite had been configured, providing 2 private chambers for the nominee, along with a reception area and workspace for his secretary and clerk. In the days that followed, dozens of senators, congressmen, cabinet officials, and members of the Republican National Committee made the train trip to Hot Springs. Overnight, the little town became the focus of national attention, just as Oyster Bay had 7 years earlier. Despite the many diversions offered by the luxurious homestead, Taft kept to a rigorous schedule. Typically awakened at 7 by his Filipino valet, he favored a spare breakfast of dry toast and a single soft-boiled egg. By 8:30, he was bathed, shaved, and settled in his office, where he read and signed responses to more than 1,500 congratulatory notes, in addition to general correspondence of nearly 150 letters every day. By 10 a.m., he was out on the 18-hole golf course with 1 or 2 invited guests. By 2 p.m., he had returned to his office, meeting with party leaders to determine strategy for each region of the country. In the late afternoon, he would devote several hours to working on his acceptance speech, scheduled for late July. At 7:30, he and Nellie went to dinner in the public dining room with their visitors before settling on the wide veranda that served as the favorite promenade for hotel guests. The week after the Tafts arrived in Hot Springs, the Democratic Party held its convention in Denver. After the defeat of their previous nominee, conservative Judge Alton Parker, the party once again turned to progressive hero William Jennings Bryan. Their platform demanded the passage of bills Roosevelt had failed to push through the Republican Congress. An 8-hour day, a General Employers Liability Act, a progressive income tax, and a child labor law. They further advocated the direct election of senators, a public record of campaign contributions, a federal guarantee of bank deposits, and a law removing tariff protection for the products of any corporation with a market share over 50%. The Democratic platform, Taft confided to Roosevelt, left him in a quandary regarding his own acceptance speech. For while he disagreed vehemently with some of their pledges, He approved many of them. "We will be able to riddle it," Roosevelt assured him in reply. A few days later, the president forwarded specific suggestions on how to slash savagely at Bryan and his platform. After working steadily for another week, Taft sent his first draft to Roosevelt. "Both of the first two paragraphs should certainly be omitted," Roosevelt replied. But aside from a weak section on bank deposits, he found the remainder of the address admirable. He added in closing, "I think that the number of times my name is used should be cut down. You are now the leader." While Taft's continued desire for the counsel of the country's most accomplished politician was understandable, his extraordinarily frank announcement that he intended to bring his final draft to Oyster Bay for Roosevelt to review provoked scorn and concern. "I have the highest regard for the president's judgment," he told the press, justifying his apparent deference to Roosevelt's opinion and a keen appreciation of his wonderful ability for forceful expression. Editorial writers universally lambasted the spectacle of candidate Taft hurrying to Oyster Bay to submit his speech of acceptance. The New York Times likened his actions to that of a schoolboy about to submit his composition to the teacher before he read it in school, and observed that, despite great admiration for Roosevelt, people would like their next president to demonstrate an existence independent of his late chief. The Sun described the sojourn as a humiliating pilgrimage, further evidence that Taft was but a puppet of the White House Punch-and-Judy manipulator. Although the copy of the speech that Taft's secretary released to the press after Roosevelt's review revealed few substantial changes, the episode was not calculated to inspire confidence in Republican breasts. From New York, Taft traveled to his brother Charlie's Cincinnati home, where the official notification ceremony and acceptance address would take place. The stately colonial mansion, with its white pillars and sweeping green lawns, provided a perfect setting for the festivities. Workers had constructed a platform and two temporary porches, flanking the imposing entrance to accommodate members of the notification committee and distinguished visitors. A flagpole, erected on the south lawn, flew a silk flag, which the local citizens had donated to honor Taft's visits to Cincinnati. The spacious grounds afforded standing room for nearly 1,500 spectators. "What we thought originally would be merely a formal affair attended by a few people," Charlie explained to a relative, "has developed into a big demonstration. Thousands streamed into Cincinnati from neighboring states to attend the open-air concerts, fireworks, receptions, and marching band performances that accompanied the main event." A large, enthusiastic crowd greeted Taft at the Cincinnati train station with an enormous banner bearing the words, "No place like home." Charles was the first to grasp his brother's hand, and they proceeded arm in arm to a waiting carriage. On the drive to the Pike Street home, where he intended to spend a quiet weekend with Nellie before Tuesday's big event, Taft appreciated the city's holiday attire, flags waving, houses draped with bunting, streets adorned with colorful streamers. On July 28th, the designated Notification Day, the booming of cannon announced a two-hour parade through the city. From the reviewing stand, Taft was gratified to observe Democrats marching side by side with Republicans in a show of bipartisanship for their favorite son. The formal ceremony began at noon, with the head of the notification committee delivering the official announcement that the Republican Party had selected William Howard Taft as its candidate for president, the highest honor that can be conferred by this constitutional republic. Taft smiled cordially and looked as much astonished as he could, and when his turn came to speak, the audience erupted in warm applause. Disregarding Roosevelt's admonishment, Taft opened with a tribute to the president's movement for practical reform, touting his leadership in securing long-overdue regulatory legislation over corporate behavior, the railroads, the food and drug industry, and the conservation of natural resources. These laws, Taft argued, offered a far more constructive avenue for curbing corporate abuses than Democratic proposals to dismantle large corporations simply because they were big. The Republican approach would compel the trusts to conduct their business in a lawful manner. while Bryan and the Democrats would simply destroy the entire business in order to stamp out the evils which they have practiced. Having commended the high standard of morality set by Roosevelt's agenda, Taft was careful to delineate a policy of his own. "The chief function of the next administration," he pledged, "is distinct from and a progressive development of that which has been performed by President Roosevelt. The chief function of the next administration is to complete and perfect the machinery by which these standards may be maintained, by which the lawbreakers may be promptly restrained and punished, but which shall operate with sufficient accuracy and dispatch to interfere with legitimate business as little as possible. Such machinery is not now adequate." Furthermore, he expressed personal support for two issues that conservative delegates had refused to sanction in the Republican Party platform: a progressive income tax and the direct election of senators. Following the official hour-long address, Taft spoke informally to friends and fellow citizens, expressing the gratitude and wonder he and Nellie felt at the spectacular reception. "Popular elections are uncertain," he concluded, "but whatever betide me as a candidate, we can never be deprived of the joy we feel at this welcome home." An elated Nellie added her own remarks. "Hasn't it been glorious?" she exclaimed. "I love public life. To me, this is better than when Mr. Taft was at the bar and at the bench, for the things before him now, and in which he takes part, are live subjects." After a luncheon party at the country club, the Tafts ended their long day on the Island Queen, escorted up the Ohio River by more than 150 smaller boats, all ablaze with illumination. From the steamer's deck, Will and Nellie witnessed a magnificent display of fireworks. 3 days later, the glow of his home city's tremendous outpouring remained with Taft. "No matter what may happen," he reflected to Roosevelt, "the joy we felt at our reception in Cincinnati was unalloyed." "I congratulate you most heartily," the president wrote. "The speech is a great success and has achieved exactly the purposes you sought to obtain. Of course, the Sun, Times, and Evening Post are dreadfully pained at your having praised me," Roosevelt gleefully observed, "or rather, as they phrase it, having submitted to my insistence that you should praise me. I am glad they did not see your speech before I got at it." In its revised form, Taft's speech garnered a positive response. The Wall Street Journal called it an exceedingly able and shrewd political document. Though not brilliant in the Roosevelt and Bryan sense, nor studded with telling phrases, the journal declared, it increased the popular faith in Mr. Taft's fitness for the high office, and perfectly positioned him in the middle of the road, avoiding alike the extreme of Eastern conservatism and the extreme of Western radicalism. Relieved that his acceptance speech was behind him, Taft returned to Hot Springs for the month of August, intending to focus on a rigorous regime of dieting and exercise. By limiting his food consumption and walking 3 or 4 hours each day over the formidable fairways of the golf course, he hoped to shed the 50 pounds he had gained during the previous year. "I play golf just as I would take medicine," he conceded to reporters. And after a brief stint of this hiking and golfing regimen under the hot sun, he proudly reported to Roosevelt that he had already lost inches in his waist. Taft's other planned activity, trail riding, had to be abandoned after the ankles of his saddle horse proved too weak to carry his weight. "No man weighing 300 pounds has any business on a horse's back," declared the president of the Massachusetts Society for the Prevention of Cruelty of Animals upon reading of the animal's collapse, callously griping, "If he must ride, let him use an automobile or an elephant." One Taft supporter offered to donate a 3,500-pound workhorse, one so large that a special stall was built to accommodate the massive creature. Undeterred, Taft continued his daily exertions on the links. With little hard news to report, correspondents resorted to detailed accounts of Taft's golf game, creating the unfortunate impression that the candidate engaged in little beyond recreation. The Tribune reporter, at least, observed that he played golf as he did everything else, with the same steadiness and poise, the same equable temper, never becoming discouraged by any obstacle, and never losing his temper or his nerve as a result of a bad play. The rash of golfing anecdotes vexed